If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back to the dialogue with Dira De Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text your thoughts to us on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. William McGimsey, free speech advocate and public policy professional, returns this week to discuss a raft of political developments in New Zealand and abroad. He's been a guest on the show before. In fact, the first show that we did talked quite heavily about immigration at the time, replacement migration, and that will come up again. We've had some new immigration news and immigration figures in this week's political activity. So welcome back to the show, William.
Now, thanks for having me on again, Dira. It's a real pleasure to join you.
So we've got a lot to go into. The Court of Appeals decision on the ability of the Waitangi Tribunal to summon ministers. We've had announcements around the Christchurch call from the Prime Minister. Again, I've mentioned the immigration numbers. There's also been various free speech developments in Wellington. Again, the attempt to cancel events that are gender critical, as they're called, critical of the transgender movement and the effect that has on children. And we've also had some good news in terms of charter schools being announced to return, and then overseas, a free speech victory for Elon Musk over Australia's e-safety commissioner. And then there are also various other geopolitical issues that we may get into at the end if we have time. So the first topic that I'd like to ask you about is the Court of Appeals decision on the Waitangi Tribunal being able to summon ministers. So it was an ACT Party minister that was basically asked to give a testimony on the repeal of part of the Oranga Tamariki Act that basically required them to take into account cultural matters for the placement of children, but is essentially sort of a ethnic or racial law that the ACT Party, the New Zealand First and National Party coalition agreements said that needed to go. And what do you think this means for New Zealand, for the Waitangi Tribunal to be able to basically intervene on a political matter before it gets to Parliament, and then having the courts determine that, actually, the Waitangi Tribunal is allowed to do this, even though, this is a political matter that they're engaging in and not a judicial matter?
Well, the Waitangi Tribunal does, I mean, primarily it exists and it was set up to deal with treaty claims. But it does have a legitimate and a legislated role in advising ministers on other aspects of public policy and legislation that affect Māori. The issue here is it's supposed to be an advisory role, and they've set themselves up in a sort of adversarial stance where they're summonsing ministers. They can basically put them on the stand and cross-examine them like a lawyer in a trial. And that's not the way it was intended to work. And what this means is they're effectively functioning like a check and a balance, which was never what they were intended. They were supposed to be provide an advisory function to ministers making decisions. Now they're setting themselves up like a check and a balance. So anytime government does any policy that affects Māori, which could potentially be any policy because all policies affect Māori in some way. And there's always, you know, every policy affects different groups of people in different ways, doesn't it? So Māori will be adversely affected by some policies more than other groups. So there's limitless possibilities for complaints to be made to the tribunal on these matters. And then the tribunal now, according to what the High Court has said, or the Court of Appeal, they can summons a minister. The minister has to go in. They put them on the stand. They can cross-examine them. And although the Waitangi Tribunal has no sort of legal ability to, you know, overturn, it has no real power. But the power to cross-examine a minister and make them justify why they're doing what they're doing, it gives the media a lot of ammunition. And just because something isn't a formal legal power to overturn legislative decisions doesn't mean it's not a power, right? Media holds a lot of power. And if you can cross-examine someone and then put that cross-examination and those answers into the media, it gives them a lot of ammunition to hammer ministers on issues relevant to Māori. And because this is an issue of race or ethnicity, it makes it even more divisive, right? So it's turned itself into a weapon. It's going to have a lot of political power, and it's going to be able to feed damaging information into the media on any issue that affects Māori. So I think this is, it's overstepping its mark. I think it's going to be a divisive thing. It was never intended to work this way. And I think it really underscores the need to reform the scope of this organization. What is it really there for? Should it still exist? Should it really be doing this anymore? And there is, in the coalition agreement, they have agreed to look at that. And Shane Jones and I believe the ACT Party as well have now made public comments in support of doing that. So let's hope that that happens.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that in my political tracker, coalitiontracker.nz, this is one of the items from the coalition agreements that I'm looking at, and it seems like it's an own goal. And I thought this at the beginning when they first made this an issue of forcing a summons. I thought this is going to backfire on them because you've got a government that it has as a election promise to modify the terms of reference for the Waitangi Tribunal, and then you're just like stepping into this political arena. Where you're in a constitutional situation here in New Zealand where we have parliamentary supremacy. And so the parliament gets to determine roughly what, you know, the constitutional arrangements are. And it seems, you know, this was initially the argument that was made in the High Court where the government won, was to say, well, okay, the tribunal may have a technical power to try and summon people and ministers in particular, but because of the principle of, I believe, comfity or comity, you can't remember which one, what it's called. My legal expertise is not that great. There's some principle there at play where the branches of government should interact in a friendly way and sometimes give way to one another on, especially if it's a political matter, that to stay with the legislature. And that decision made by the High Court seemed to be sort of a way for them to save face in terms of, okay, cool, the Waitangi Tribunal is going to step back from the politics. But no, they went and appealed this. And it doesn't seem like the government is going to appeal it to the Supreme Court or anything along those lines. They may simply accept the decision and then make a legislative change. That's often what governments do, right? They lose in the court. Well, guess what? You can just make legislation that that undoes the judiciary. And that's actually an important part of how New Zealand's constitutional arrangements work.
Yeah, we don't want to be ruled by the judiciary. We want to be ruled by the people's representatives. The judiciary has an important role in our constitutional architecture, but it's not in charge. So, I mean, I think you're right. If the government handles this correctly, it does create momentum for introducing these, you know, legislative changes around changing the scope of the Waitangi Tribunal and what it's allowed to do. But do you have confidence that our Prime Minister will pursue that direction, or do you think that's a bit iffy? I mean, I have confidence that New Zealand First will. I have confidence that ACT would, but I'm not so confident when it comes to Mr. Luxon.
And that is the big problem, is it not? The question of the day, the question that we could attach to most of the political issues that we're discussing, most of the developments that we've seen really come down to, okay, well, what does Mr. Luxon think of this? What is Mr. Luxon going to do? And we saw just this week what he does on some of these issues. It seems like New Zealand First basically insisted the Christchurch call be ended. It seems like the ACT Party wanted it to be ended as well, because they both had social media releases saying the Christchurch call has been defunded. The Christchurch call is gone. That was the impression we got. And then you get the press conference with Christopher Luxon, with the Prime Minister, and he makes a grand speech about how the Christchurch call is going to be morphed into an NGO, a non-governmental organization. And these NGOs are incredibly powerful in democratic world, kind of a non-democratic organizations that wield a lot of government power, unfortunately. And so the Christchurch call is going to become the Christchurch Call Foundation. It's going to even have its own patron saint in Jacinda Ardern. When they announced her as a patron, I thought,
should be a matron. What's the, I'm not, if I brush up on my Latin, like, Cater is male and matron is female. Is that right?
It should be. It should be. That's right. We should use this properly. We can refer to her as the matron saint.
Perhaps it's patron because she's so patronizing.
That could also be a derivative from the Latin, certainly. So I guess is your thoughts on this, that this is a betrayal by Luxon? Is this NGO going to just be like a noose around our necks that's going to continually try and strangle us with censorship? Or do we see the slow death of the Christchurch core here in a more drawn-out fashion? Because it seemed to be called into question in recent weeks, where there was a report saying that governments were basically censoring the Christchurch core, where the Christchurch core was creating these reports into these governments and how they were supposed to be censoring free speech, and that they weren't doing a good job of it. And then these governments basically threatened to withdraw from the Christchurch call, and then their reports were buried. Very ironic. So is it getting more power or less power? What's your view on the situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I think both options are possible. I lean towards it still being a powerful force for censorship. Because if you know, all that's really been removed is the New Zealand government funding for the Secretariat. And New Zealand government is a very small component of the huge international organizations and governments who are interested in censorship. There's no shortage of governments and international organizations, NGOs, lobby groups that want to censor information and opinions they don't like on the internet. And so I think there's every reason to believe that the Christchurch Core Foundation will continue trying to do that. And now, actually, the government has, it seems as if the government actually has less power over this organization. It's not funding it. And the patron, Jacinda Ardern, no longer has to report into the Prime Minister about what she's doing, as far as I understand. So in a way, it could be more powerful. Now, when people who were critical of the Christchurch Core, what they were saying is they wanted this organization to not exist anymore. They wanted it to stop censoring the internet and defunding it. You know, I support defunding it, right? We don't want to spend money on organizations that don't do anything valuable. Just cutting the funding isn't really the primary concern that most people had. The primary concern most people had was that there's this organization out there that's censoring us off the internet. They say they're doing it because they're trying to prevent terrorism, but that's not really why they're doing it. They're going after people with political views they don't like. And the way, what they're doing is they're saying, you know, we're here to stop terrorism and violent extremism. Oh, but by the way, if you believe reducing immigration is a good policy, you're a violent extremist. And they've continued to call all sorts of beliefs that ordinary people have to conflate them with violent extremism, even to the point where if you believe a woman is a biological category, right, that's violent extremism. Or if it's not violent extremism, it's you're on the pathway to radicalization, towards being a violent extremist, if you believe that. That's crazy stuff. You know, they've lost the plot.
Yeah. Thankfully, the Christchurch call doesn't have like a list or a website like the ADL where they've got the list of people that they don't like or categorize as extremists. But if they did, I'm sure that RCR would be on it. All of Reality Check Radio, you know, questioning the government narrative, that's radicalization and extremism. And, you know, they probably have an internal list. And I guarantee you that anyone involved with RCR is on their list, basically, of people they would like to censor. As you mentioned, the continued existence of this organization is a very bad thing for us. Even if it doesn't have any power over, you know, the governments directly, it's that lobbying power, that soft power, that nagging in the background.
Well, I think you can think too much of formal legislative, formal government power. And a lot of power is wielded through networks, right? Through knowing the right people and having the right relationships and levers to pull to get what you want. That's why international NGOs have so much power, right? Mm-hmm. International NGOs have no legislative power, yet they wield enormous influence over governments. And the big fear here is that the Christchurch Core Foundation will operate in the same manner. But I want to go back to your earlier point about how the communications around this were rolled out, because that's an interesting point too. New Zealand First put out a tweet, which I saw, and this is prior to Luxon's announcement of what was happening, saying they defunded the call. ACT put out a media release, I think, and some stuff on social media saying, oh, yes, we've defunded the call with a bit more explanatory information. But then an hour or two later, you see the joint announcement from Christopher Luxon and Emmanuel Macron saying, you know, no, we've got a Christchurch Cool Foundation now. So the organization still exists. It's still going to be doing the same sort of work that it was doing before. So, the defunding doesn't really mean a whole lot in that context, I don't think.
No, so we have some political posturing from New Zealand First and ACT where they're chalking up victories that they haven't really won. Like you said, the people who are happy to hear the news it was defunded were all of the people who wanted it gone. And suddenly they find out it's not gone. And then,
Well, if you hear that an organization's been defunded, you kind of think, oh, good, it's not going to exist anymore. But that's not what happened here, is it?
No, that's not what happened. So disappointing there. And clearly, like I said, Luxon, going back to when we talk about the Waitangi Tribunal, that's Christopher Luxon, at the end of the day, actually wields a lot of power in this coalition. And people say that Luxon is you know, powerless, or he's being taken for a ride. Clearly not the case when we see these decisions being made, the direction that he's taking things in. Christopher Luxon is very much in charge. He's clearly a clever man, and he may not, you know, sort of toot his own horn where he's doing what you would expect Winston Peters and David Seymour to do, and always, you know, being the first, like in this case, the first one to make an announcement, the loudest in the room, as it were, and he's the quiet one in the back scheming away, pulling the strings. So I think I'll pull in a different issue here as well that I was going to leave for later, but I think it fits in really well here with the when we were talking about NGOs having power to censor the internet. We see that a lot on social media, where these organizations will create these networks to get things censored by Facebook, by Twitter, Instagram, and so on. And we even had governments doing this, and it wasn't until Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter that he really started to release documents saying, hey, the governments gave us censorship requests and we've declined them, and here they're public. But guess what? Like Facebook, they just accept every single censorship request that they get and they don't tell you about it. You know, and Instagram and even TikTok and so on are saying all of these censorship requests are being pushed into these organizations. And you, the end user, you don't really know who's behind it and who's doing it. In the case of Twitter now, or X, as Elon Musk calls it, he is making all this public, even going to court in Australia against the e-safety commissioner on the video of the attempted stabbing, or the actual stabbing, but non-fatal stabbing of the Eastern Orthodox bishop several weeks ago now. And they attempted to have that pulled from the internet. And we saw in some of those court documents as well that other countries, including the Christchurch Call and Jacinda Ardern, had been trying to get those videos pulled from Twitter. And thankfully, he managed to win. So what are your thoughts on that case, and I guess the impact it's going to have on censorship in general?
Well, I think what's important to note here is this is a preliminary victory, and it concerns one aspect of the case, and there's going to be ongoing legal action on other aspects of the censorship activity here. And in fact, Australia's eSafety Commissioner, I think we learned today, has actually appealed even the decision that they lost on. So this particular decision was around, so Twitter took down the video, they geo-blocked the video of Marmari Emmanuel's stabbing in Australia, but they didn't take it down in the rest of the world. And the takedown order from the eSafety Commissioner kind of implied that they had to take it down everywhere. And Twitter argued, well, look, you don't have jurisdiction to tell us to take down things over the whole world. Your jurisdiction is Australia. That would be a vast overreach of your legal jurisdiction to tell us to take that down all around the world. And they won on that basis. There's, I think, as far as I understand, and I could be incorrect here, but I think there's an appeal on the specific Australia censorship aspect as well. So Twitter and Elon Musk are also going to appeal that. And the eSafety Commissioner, like I say, has appealed this ruling as well. So this legal action is going to drag on for a long time as they appeal and reappeal the various parts of it. But going back to what you were saying about the Twitter files, and what we learned from the Twitter files was really horrendous. There was basically a revolving door between Twitter employees and people involved in the US national intelligence agencies. And not only was there a revolving door in terms of employees, there was also, you know, people with from within the government were basically ringing up Twitter or emailing Twitter and saying, can you censor this guy? Can you censor that guy? And Twitter was basically doing that. And all this was exposed during the Twitter files. And when Elon came in, he fired a whole bunch of the people who were involved in this activity, in their activity around censorship and, you know, e-safety. And Julianne McGrant, the Australian e-safety commissioner, she's a former Twitter employee who was doing this stuff in Twitter. And then she got picked up by the Australian government to do this stuff.
It's so wild.
That's, I mean, it's wild, really, isn't it? It's crazy.
Well, it's a conspiracy. You think it was a conspiracy, you know, like if somebody told you, oh, yeah, they have these people who work for the intelligence agencies and the social media companies and the NGOs, and they're all working together and they're ringing each other up on who to censor. You would have thought that was a crazy story until Elon Musk revealed that that is exactly what had been happening. And is still happening. I say it is still happening. This is still happening on every other social media network.
Yes. Twitter is one of the most free social media networks now, the most pro-free speech social media networks. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's happening everywhere else on all the other networks. If Twitter were to be taken out or were to, you know, like change its policy on censorship, that would be a huge loss in terms of, you know, the promotion of free speech worldwide. It's sort of, it's the tip of the spear in promoting free speech around the world now.
One other censorship-related item that came up this week was the Department of Internal Affairs in New Zealand announcing that they had basically their own Ministry of Truth that they were setting up. Or I believe they've been doing this for a while, so the announcement was not new, but it was called the Safer Online Services and Media Platforms proposal. And the minister in charge of the DIA said, it's no longer being considered. I'm sorry, at this time, I forget who the minister in charge of the DIA is, you might know, but I think it's somebody from the ACT Party.
Is it Brooke Van Gelder?
Yes, Brooke, that's right. Now that you mention her name, I saw her in connection with this, and I think she did a big press release about it, actually, just the other day, and saying the agency is no longer considering this completely insane internal policies that would result in just massive censorship, not just of media platforms, not just social media. We're talking all media, whether it be, I guess, anything from newspapers, broadcasters, and so on, any kind of online content, and they wanted to be able to regulate that.
That's right, and they would do so through publishing codes of practice that would set out the types of things, the types of harms that they were looking to prevent across various types of media. But that's not the worst part of it. They were proposing to set up an organization that would handle this, that would be kind of independent of government, would be an independent regulator. So the government would have not so much control over it. That's really a Ministry of Truth, right? And in a way, this proposal was kind of the centerpiece of the Ardern government's idea of, you know, censoring the internet and censoring media so that only views that they thought were favorable could get out. They tried the hate speech laws. The hate speech laws failed. They tried mis- and disinformation with some success. They claimed that views that they disagreed with were mis- and disinformation or conspiracy theories, and they you know, employed Sanjana Hatatua to go on breakfast TV and publish these reports about what was misinformation and disinformation and what wasn't. But none of this has any credibility because it's not. They were just going after opinions that were against sort of the Jacinda Ardern's left-wing views. But yeah, it's a big victory to get this cancelled. But one worries that this work is just going to be taken over now by the Christchurch call, and it's going to be done on a sort of international basis rather than on a New Zealand national basis. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, so a key part of this, definitely the Christchurch call will not be able to pick up, was that this regulatory body that you mentioned was actually going to be able to fine social media and internet-based content platforms for breaching the rules that they would set up. Potentially, that could have even extended to media organizations like RCR, where they'd be, you know, that was kind of, they want to try and capture media firms that don't voluntarily abide by the various self regulatory schemes like the Media Council, the Broadcasting Standards Authority. In many ways, you know, their media organizations could voluntarily set up standards that they would enforce between themselves and each other and so on, which is, of course, perfectly fine. And companies should be free to do that in a commercial way, no problem at all. And And but because I guess they, like you mentioned, they said, oh, these platforms are sharing misinformation and disinformation, we're going to force them to abide by these regulations, and then we're going to fine them when they break the regulations. And had we had, I guess, 3 more years of labor, like this would almost certainly have come into play at some stage. And they basically wanted to head off any competition that the mainstream media faced, and any kind of, I guess, you know, takeovers of social media firms like Elon Musk taking over Twitter and making it more pro-free speech, they'd be able to basically cut all of this off and censor them. And I know there are some countries in Europe, for instance, who basically have these regulatory bodies. I know that France and Germany and so on regularly fine or attempt to fine social media platforms in a similar way. And you end up with a lot less content available in your country, and people are less able to access information because you have a massive chilling effect inside the country. And then you have these basically firewalls that are geo-blocking of content from, you know, that's available internationally. And as we were just talking about, the final manifestation of that is with the Australian eSafety Commissioner trying to enforce, you know, global bans on content. You'd think it would be absurd, and I'm very glad to see that stopped in New Zealand for now.
Yes, I agree.
So coming to the immigration numbers that were announced this week, basically, and I think this is a little, I don't think they break them down as granularly as I would like, because they announce like the yearly figures every quarter or every month. They kind of give you figures for the past year from month to month. So they give you now the figures from, say, May to May last year. Again, very high immigration numbers, but below the peak that we previously discussed on the show a few months ago, 3 months ago now, I think. But we did have some worse news in terms of the highest ever number of Kiwis leaving the country, basically, in the last year, most of which probably left during Labor's term. But still, I mean, it's 6 months since the election, pretty much, almost. And so these numbers are still looking pretty bad to me. So what's your opinion on the current immigration numbers and where they're headed?
Yeah, well, basically, the incredibly high numbers of people coming into the country has stayed, you know, roughly the same as what it was when we spoke, however many months ago it was. So it's about 238,000 people have come into New Zealand over the year to March 2024. And it was, I think, 250-something thousand. So yeah. It's still very much in the same ballpark. And that's probably the highest figure in the world in terms of the gross number of new people arriving. I think probably we've got the highest number in the world. If we haven't got exactly the highest number in the world, it'd be one of the highest numbers.
Certainly the highest in the Western world. And I know I mentioned this to a previous guest where I said, hey, we've got 5%. I sometimes mention it's our international guest, say 5% of the population arriving in the last 12 months. And they look at me like, how's the country still standing? They're just completely shocked. Because these countries that are complaining, you know, where you have these massive anti-immigration movements and people are up in arms about immigration, it's like 2%, you know, 2%, 3% every year. And they're, you know, people are complaining because it's basically crippling the country. And yet in New Zealand, it seems to be, I guess, well hidden, I guess, the effect, like the negative effects of high immigration on the economy and society in general.
I'm not sure the negative effects. I mean, we're having all the same negative effects. Everywhere where this sort of large-scale immigration is happening, they have housing crises, they have immigration deficits, they have depressed wages, they have struggling GDP per capita numbers. So that the issues are the same in all the places this is happening. Probably it's talked about less in New Zealand. Immigration seems to be less of a problem in the public polling or in the, you know, the public mood. Public don't seem to link immigration to these problems as strongly as in New Zealand as they do elsewhere, which I think is a shame because, like you say, the problem is bigger. However, what's different in these numbers is, so while the huge number of people coming in has stayed roughly where it was, we've also got a record number of New Zealand citizens leaving the country this time, over 50,000, 52,000, I think it was. The previous record was the February 2014 year or the February 2012 year,
yeah,
where it was 40-something thousand, 42,000, 44,000, something like that. So that's a significant increase of around 10,000 from the previous record for the number of Kiwi citizens leaving. This is a brain drain, right? When we've talked about brain drains in the past, people have referred to, people have used that term to mean, you know, a net loss of people. But this is a loss of Kiwi citizens while we're still having a huge influx of non-Kiwi citizens into the country. So this is more like a replacement, a great replacement, we could call it. The greatest proportional replacement perhaps that's happening anywhere in the Western world right now. And that's what's going on. We're losing Kiwis. We're bringing in people from China, India, the Philippines, places like that to replace them. So the face of New Zealand is changing. And this is something I think that we need to talk about. Is this the type of New Zealand that people want to live in?
And when I previously discussed the announcements that the immigration minister, Erica Stanford, had made around changes that she was making, she pointed out saying, one of the problems that we have is that most of the immigration in the last year has been in the low income category. So I guess that potentially makes the problem even worse, because the people who are more likely to leave your country are people who are well off and making more money, perhaps, and want to make even more money overseas. They have some kind of mobility, social mobility, economic mobility. They're leaving your country, and then the replacement coming in is very much targeted at lower income people, which, yeah, I guess has knock-on effects on the overall economy, where we have, I guess now increased unemployment and so on will be especially at the lower end, which creates a lot more strain on social services and I guess is going to have a lot of ramifications that may take years for people to feel. Or do you think that these effects would be felt fairly quickly by people?
I think the effects would be felt quickly. I mean, we're in a GDP per capita recession, right? So the GDP refers to the overall size of the economy. And of course, if you bring in more people, that's likely to increase the size of the economy, because people, you know, they work, they buy things. If you have more people, you have more economic activity. But the measure that really matters in terms of people's living standards is GDP per capita. It's the size of the economy divided across the number of people. And that's been going down in New Zealand, even as the huge numbers of people have been coming in. So that's a policy failure. Like this policy of doing this isn't improving New Zealanders' living standards. And it, you know, if you bring in low-skilled people, they're going to do low-paying jobs. That's going to depress your average wages. And that's for the Kiwis who are still here trying to get those jobs. It puts downward pressure on the wages that they get. Low-skilled people are more likely to be unemployed. They're more likely to use welfare benefits if they stay here and become entitled to them. And they're less likely to be able to pay the rent. They contribute less to the economy on the spending side. It's not a good deal. If we're going to have large amounts of immigration, let's at least try and target the high-skilled people who are going to contribute more in terms of earning. It's actually better for equality of your wages as well, because it puts downward pressure on the high wages and doesn't do anything bad, doesn't put downward pressure on the people on the low wages. So if you focus on high-skilled immigration, you actually has more of an equalizing effect on wages. It helps low-skilled New Zealanders more. So, yeah, we should be focusing on high-skilled immigration. We should also be reducing the total numbers of people coming here. But if we are going to have lots of people coming here, let's at least focus on the high-skilled.
And that is what the immigration minister has officially announced is supposed to be happening. It's supposed to be the new immigration policy. I guess we'll just have to wait and see and touch base again and when the next numbers come out. And yeah, I guess the numbers do lag a little bit, but not by much. So we should be able to see if any policy changes are having any effect, and people can then hold the government to account and say, hey, you promised some changes in this area. And inevitably will be linked to our economic recovery. If we're going to see an economic recovery in the next year, you know, this is going to have to be part of it. So it'd be a good thing for people to keep an eye on and potentially keep the government to account on. So if you are listening on the radio, we're just speaking with William McGimsey, and you may have just tuned in. He has been on the show before. We are going over some of the political events, especially in New Zealand, and we may touch on some geopolitical issues as well. We've talked about the Waitangi Tribunal, the Christchurch call, immigration numbers, and also some censorship issues. And I'd like to come back to one last censorship issue here for today. There's an event planned on Saturday called Inflection Point, or hosted by the group, the organization known as Inflection Point. And their focus is on what would be called gender critical or anti-transgender policies and information. And there's been a big outcry. I say big outcry, but the outcry itself has got a lot of attention from councillors in Wellington who have basically made hints that they would like to see this event censored, cancelled. And I guess the Free Speech Union has stepped in there to defend this event. And the event itself has quite an... Actually, I was looking at the list of speakers, very broad range of speakers from the author of the WPATH files, which was the documents that revealed widespread medical malpractice on children in transgender healthcare. You've got somebody from Women's Sports in Australia. You've got a journalist there, Bob McCrosbury from Family First. You've got Brian Tamaki as well, and former National MP Simon O'Connor, another journalist, Rachel Stewart, who may be familiar to many of the listeners here, and she's appeared on RCR a number of times, as have actually quite a few of the people who are attending. So quite a very diverse event in terms of a broad range of perspectives on this particular issue. And yeah, I guess the capital, Wellington, is the hotbed of what people would call wokeness, the progressive agenda. Do you think this event is going to go ahead without issue? Are there going to be safety concerns, protests, possible violence? There seems to be a massive amount of uncertainty around that event at the moment.
I think I would probably expect a counter-protest of some sort. The group appears to have security in place, and all indications are at this point it's going to go ahead. And that's good. Let's try and put into context here how incorrect these claims that the councillors and others are making about the harmful, what's being said in this conference is harmful. They're saying that the things that are being said are harmful, but what's being claimed by the people in this conference, one of the main things, is around the prescription of puberty blockers to young children with gender dysphoria. And as the WPATH files and some of the other information that's come out has shown, when you use puberty blockers on young kids, you can chemically castrate them, right? Which is a pretty serious thing. You can sterilize them. They're no longer able to have children. It's more likely to put them on a medical pathway where they then take the cross-sex hormones after, and turn boys into girls and vice versa. And the people who engage in this don't have very good life outcomes if you look at it. They're more likely to, they're going to be on drugs the rest of their life. They have, serious mental problems in lots of cases. Then they undergo surgery, they get mutilated if they want to do the transgender surgery. So those are some real harms, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Castration, sterilization is being on drugs the rest of your life, increasing your risk of suicide. Those are real harms. And so I'm worried about those harms. And if people who are worried about the harms of, transgender people having their feelings hurt or something like that, that is just not important by comparison. And so we need to get some perspective about what's really harmful and what's not.
And what about these councillors getting involved here then? Is that appropriate for councillors to be doing this? And are there going to be any consequences, this being Wellington? Maybe in another part of the country, you'd have some people would be upset about their representatives. Is this a case where the constituency in Wellington seems to be sort of aligned with these councillors, or are they part of the just a radical agenda and they're activists who have been put into councils where the electorate's not paying attention?
Well, I think based on the voting, you would have to assume that there is a constituency for this sort of thing in Wellington, and that they're engaged in political signalling to the people who vote for them, to their supporters. So I think, I think it's a genuine political calculation they're making to be, making these sorts of noises about censorship. But that doesn't mean that we all have to like it.
And the Free Speech Union has come out here in defense of the event as well, said that they want to make sure it takes place, that they would take legal action if necessary if the council doesn't uphold its neutrality and ability for people to hold public events. But there seemed to be a little bit of a snide remarks in some of the press releases from the Free Speech Union about Brian Tamaki, saying that he's tried to censor the other side in this and that they've supported everyone being able to have their events and have their say. I've had Brian Tamaki on the show as recently as last week, and I think in the past his response has basically been, the Free Speech Union should go away because they're wrong, which is a very Brian Tamaki response. Yeah, is the Free Speech Union, are there concerns, I guess, valid, or is it a political calculation that the Free Speech Union is doing as well when they're saying, the actual trans events and when they want to have drag queen story hour for children and stuff, that's all free speech as well, and or what the trans lobby is doing, all of that is free speech as well, and everyone's going to have their say. How do you which side do you come down on? Is Brian Tamaki right here when he says no, that's not a free speech issue? And I think most of the speakers, looking at the list of speakers at the Inflection Point event, most of them say the same thing, like it's not a free speech issue to give drag queens access to children and so on.
Yeah, well, the issue surrounds what free speech scholars call the heckler's veto, right? Or the thug's veto. So the heckler's veto is the idea of, someone wants to say something and you shout them down so they can't say it. So the people who go to their events can't hear what they're saying. Thug's veto, one manifestation of that would be around denying people a venue or a platform at which to speak. So, legally they have the right to speak, but in a practical sense, no one ever gets to hear them because they can't hire venues, the venues cancel on them, they can't get on the TV, they can't get on the radio, all that sort of thing. And so that's what's going on here. If the Inflection Point New Zealand event is cancelled because of councillors or political activists saying these sorts of things, that will be an example of the thug's veto. And the Free Speech Union is rightly pointing that out and saying, no, they're going to go into bat for the Inflection Point New Zealand people, for the organisers, and make sure, or do what they can to try and make sure that this event goes ahead. The issue they have with Brian Tamaki is that, according to what they say, Brian Tamaki hasn't afforded that same level of tolerance to the Drag Queen Story Hour people, because he tried to allegedly shut down their events. Now, there's some truth in that. Brian did try to shut down their events, but there's a legitimate point, I think, to be made here about what's a legitimate free speech and what isn't. And in my view is, we have well-established safeguards for children in our democracy. There are things that you can't take your children to if they're too young. You can't take your children to R16 or R18 movies, for example. And there's a number of things like that as well. We protect children from violence. We protect them from bad language, and we protect them from sexual themes. And most people would agree that that's appropriate. And I think that the drag queen story time stuff would fall into that sort of category. Now, the Free Speech Union is arguing that this should really be an issue of parents being able to choose what they take their children to see and what they don't take them to see. But my view is there are shared standards that we have in society that we enforce on everyone else, like R16 and R18 movies, for example. And there's a number of other areas as well of things we take that decision away from parents. Parents aren't allowed to take their children to certain things. And I think that this should fall into that sort of category.
On the subject of, I guess, what parents are and I'm not allowed to do, I thought right away, taking children to school, for instance, is a requirement. Parents are forced to make sure that children get an education. And then that works very well to introduce the next topic and the last local political topic that I have around charter schools that have now been announced as coming back. David Seymour announced over $100 million would be set aside in the next 3 years or 2.5 years in the rest of the parliamentary term to make sure that at least 50 charter schools would be established, including 35 state school conversions. And all of this to give parents more choice in education, and which seems excellent to me. What's your view on charter schools coming back, and do you believe that they will last? You know, because previously the unions, the teachers' unions, and the Labour Party were successful in shutting down the charter school project. Is it going to be a permanent fixture in New Zealand? What would you believe the impact on the education system will be to have this freedom?
Well, I'm very pro charter school, and the reason is it breaks the stranglehold that the Ministry of Education people, the cultural Marxist socialist Ministry of Education people, have over controlling what kids are allowed to learn. These are the people who want them to learn about, you know, gender stuff in the schools, and they want them to learn about, you know, white people being evil colonizers, everything white people did in New Zealand being bad, and Maori being wonderful about everything. That's the new, you know, the history curriculum I'm alluding to there. So I think anything that could be done to take power away from those people and introduce different options for parents and communities is a good thing. So charter schools would be able to, you know, they'd have more freedom around the types of things that they would teach. I think aspects of the curriculum would still apply, but they would negotiate. You're going to say something?
Yes, I think that looking at what charter schools officially involve was basically complete freedom in terms of the curriculum that they teach. And the at least when David Seymour made his announcement, he basically said the only constraint was going to be around outcomes, that the contract between the government and the charter schools would be around outcomes. And that as long as they continue to achieve those outcomes, then the entire curriculum would be up to them. In fact, even operating hours would be up to charter schools, the people that they hire and so on. Like, it sounds, at least the way that he announced it, like they have more freedom than private schools do. And
that's even better than what I thought. I mean, I thought they would have had to negotiate sort of the curriculum, the things that we're teaching with the ministry. But if what you're saying is correct, I mean, that's even better, isn't it? It gives parents and communities even more freedom. And it's not just the freedom, it's the competition. If these schools are allowed to do something differently, we can see whether the different things that they do, the different ways that they teach, whether it works better, because we'll be able to measure the outcomes in these charter schools against the outcomes that are being achieved in the state schools. And the potential is there to offer something new and different and better, and that may have the effect in the long run of driving improvements in performance in the state schools as well. So I think it's all positive.
Yeah, definitely a big change. And I believe this could be one of the biggest changes. And I know that in the election night live stream that I did with Right Minds and Tim Wilms and the Unshackled in Australia, I mentioned basically saying, hey, this could be the biggest opportunity for the coalition government, is if charter schools could come back, if they could break the power of the teachers' unions, that could completely change New Zealand in, say, a generation. Because A, teachers no longer have to be forced through the indoctrination to get their qualifications, because basically when teachers unions talk about qualified teachers, they have like a 6-month indoctrination program where you get indoctrinated with Marxist ideas around how children should be raised, and then you have to join the teachers union and so on. And then the curriculum that's enforced at the schools, developed at the Ministry of Education, again, a radical left-wing curriculum. As soon as you free a significant portion of the population from that kind of indoctrination, it could have a massive, massive impact on New Zealand society in say 20 years. You wouldn't see it right away, probably, but in 20 years, New Zealand could look completely different. The political opinions of New Zealanders and what is, you know, the way that people vote. It's hard to imagine, I think, the possibilities. And it seems like this is a very forward-thinking idea, and perhaps that the ACT Party and David Seymour in particular are thinking about how charter schools could shape New Zealand. And this is where you can see that the radical left in New Zealand is very concerned about charter schools. I think they see this threat, and it's one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of it. I send my kids to a private Christian school, and we pay a lot of money for, like, we pay for the public schools and we pay for the private schools, you know, but we pay for that. We make that sacrifice because of the kind of education we want our children to have. And it's a potential that a nationwide charter school program could basically relieve the financial pressure and basically give every child in New Zealand and every parent in New Zealand the opportunity for children to have the quality of a private school education for free, or you know, for their taxes, instead of having to pay double.
Yeah, I think the key to beating it in, and I think this is something they might have learned, is to go big. If people have a school that they like, they're going to kick up an awful fuss if the next government comes in and wants to shut it down. And the more of those schools that you have, the more of the fuss that's going to be created if the Labor government wants to come in and shut it down next time. So they're going for 50 charter schools, which I think that's more than they ever had last time, isn't it? And I think that's the key. We need to have as many of these things as they can to make it as difficult as possible for Labor to repeal it when they come in next.
I don't know the exact numbers. Like, there are only two charter schools that I always hear about, but I think the total number was less than a dozen last time. And that was just not enough, easy enough for them to shut it down. Like you say, 50 now, and assuming the government is not a one-term government, and I'm glad that he's going big, because 50, and say it's a one-term government, you've got 50 of these schools, that may be big enough to entrench it. But say you get another term out of this government, you've got another 3 years, and they grow this, you know, exponentially, basically, and they go from 50 to, say, add on an extra 100, 150, you've got 200 charter schools running by the time that your two turns in, then that system is locked in forever. And that would be a great thing to see. So I'm glad. I want to see how this develops, of course. You know, the devil could be in the details. We could just have had the fancy good news announced, and then when it gets down to actual legislation, and when it gets down to implementation, it may not be as good as it sounds. But I'm very stoked with this news.
Me too.
And that wraps up the local issues. I guess there's a slight, I guess, a local regional issue I could ask you about. And I had a panel about this last week. AUKUS, the agreement between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which New Zealand could be involved in terms of its second pillar, which would basically set up an agreement for research and development of usually military products to be standardized between the Anglosphere nations. Do you think it's a good deal for New Zealand to be involved in AUKUS? And, you know, there have been some high-profile opposition to it, like both Helen Clark and Don Brash have said that they don't support AUKUS. And there's even John Key, I guess, is opposed because they tend to be more favorable towards China, our number one trading partner. So yeah, where do you see that alignment? I guess if we're having a multipolar world, if there's a risk on either side, you know, do we go with one or the other, or do we try and remain neutral? And is that even a possibility to be neutral?
Yeah, well, I mean, the AUKUS agreement is perceived, and I think correctly, as a tool for managing Chinese influence in the Pacific. And were we to sign up with it, we would be aligning ourselves more with our traditional allies, Australia, the US, and the UK. And if, you know, China is now our biggest trading partner, like you've mentioned, and it's a big destination for our milk powder and our red meat as well. And these are National Party and ACT Party constituents. So that's very important. So what's been criticized here by people like Helen Clark and Don Brash as well, so it's not just a left-right thing, is that this would, moving closer to AUKUS or signing AUKUS, would jeopardize our independent foreign policy, right? We would be gradually roped into supporting US-led efforts around the world. And even though we haven't signed AUKUS already, you can see that we, in many of our other foreign policy decisions, we've moved closer to what the US is doing. So if you look at the support for Ukraine, you know, that was rather uncritical support for Ukraine. And there's a number of other issues as well. So I think the risk there is if we align ourselves too closely with the US, we might be getting roped into fighting in wars, US-led wars. And the US has, in the last half century, the US has got a pretty, or more than half century now, but the US has got a pretty well-established record of starting a lot of wars that perhaps don't need to be started, losing a lot of soldiers, losing a lot of money, and not ending up doing a lot of good in those wars. And it's created a lot of political protest at home and throughout the entire Western world because of those wars. Is being roped into supporting those wars as part of a security agreement something that we really want to do? So I'm going to stay on the fence here. I'm a little bit skeptical that aligning ourselves more with the US, Australia, and UK, and away from China and Russia is in our interests. I'm skeptical it's going to do us, whether it's going to do us more good than harm. Guess what people really want is they want the security of knowing you've got, you know, big bad America backing you up. If, you know, if something really bad were to happen in terms of a military threat to New Zealand, I guess that's the big raw card that people want out of it. But the question is, how likely is that really?
Well, out of, I think, three guests now, I've got no one to commit either way for or against AUKUS. So yes, that speaks to just how difficult and controversial this situation, the geopolitical situation that New Zealand finds itself in, as we, and I, like I mentioned, that multipolar or bipolar world where you've got the US-NATO axis and the Russia-China bloc. And yeah, New Zealanders don't want to get drawn in on either side, which is fair, but then it's hard to think like, okay, well, China's a number one trading partner. It's hard, you know, especially when the Chinese power is very much about economic power. And, you know, how do we maintain our independence if we can't do without Chinese trade and so on? So this could get very interesting if we do enter a world recession as well. I think the calculations may change for people. If China becomes a lot more inward looking, you could suddenly see, you know, the opinions of New Zealanders change quite quickly as we realize, oh, we're not actually that dependent on China for trade anymore. But that could be, you know, long-term changes that at this point are very hard to predict.
Well, another thing that's ticking away in the back of my mind here is that our traditional allies are all woke, right? They all promote the same type of political correctness and wokeism that I spend a lot of my time on Twitter railing against. Whereas China and Russia and some of these other countries now, they're not woke at all. They're based, right?
Yeah.
So it's, I wish it were the other way around, but it's not. And so that weighs on your decision-making a little bit too.
Yeah, right. I mean, if we have a massive amount of Chinese influence and Chinese takeover of New Zealand, at least they're not going to try and censor your speech around some of these social issues. But I guess the censorship, the problems you might encounter, you know, from Russia and China are completely different. But then, yeah, they may be issues that you personally don't care about so much. So it's an interesting thing for people to think about. You know, every power has its own ideology that it pushes, and maybe if you align yourself more with that ideology, you're not really going to care about some of the, you know, some of the downsides. Basically, you mentioned Ukraine very quickly. I'll just go back to that. Our support for Ukraine. What's your view overall of the Ukraine war and where it's going at the moment? Just very briefly, in like a 1 or 2 minute summary. New Zealand's support for Ukraine is. At this point, unconditional. We're very much on their side of the war, as it were. Are we going to, you know, regret that, or there's the situation at least appears to me to be deteriorating, and perhaps more rapidly than anybody on the Western world is willing to admit.
Well, Ukraine has been wrecked, right? A large proportion of the population has left the country, and it's been bombed. Many people have been killed. It's been a sinkhole for a whole lot of US and Western money in terms of aid, and all the money and resources that we poured into it are not going to result in a victory in all likelihood. What's probably going to happen is some sort of, and speculative, but what's probably going to happen is some sort of settlement where Russia keeps the eastern portion. Yeah, the eastern portion, and a rump reduced Ukraine is left in the West. Or perhaps the war will just trudge on into infinity like the Afghanistan occupation did. But either way, that's bad. One of the things that I speculate about is whether, or that I have speculated about, is whether what the tactic here is to get Russia embroiled in a long-term occupation that's going to wear them down financially and militarily, like the US got involved in Afghanistan. I wonder whether, you know, the US has kind of learned its lesson from the Afghanistan conflict and thought, well, it's better to be on the other side of that rather than being the occupying power, draw the other guy into being the occupying power and let them deplete their resources and their military. So maybe that's what's happening.
That's an interesting theory, and we'll definitely see as that develops. Yeah, just as I say this every time it comes up, very tragic situation, and you know, feel very much for the Ukrainians, and feel like, you know, we're supporting them in this war, and you know, we're handing them the bullets, but at the end of the day, they're the ones that are putting their lives on the line and probably dying in what is going to be an unnecessary war, you know, in terms of if they're going to have to settle for what they would have lost at the beginning, then the war itself really would have been a waste for Ukraine. And then I guess a little bit further to the south as well, in a similar geographic triangle there, there's current war happening in Gaza as well. Brought this up on the show last week, but it was very early on in terms of Israeli action in Rafah. And it doesn't seem to have developed much in the last week, really, which was my prediction that they would move very, very slowly enough to keep their people sort of happy. The factions in the Israeli government, I believe, it basically wanted some action. And so that kind of looks to me like they're getting that little bit of action, but not enough to cause a massive amount of international outcry. Do you see any likely resolution there, or is it going to grind on as well?
Well, that's a tough one to gaze into your crystal ball and figure out. But the military action from Israel has ramped up. So they are going into Rafah basically now. 450,000 Palestinians have fled Rafah. And there's also, they're re-upping their military engagement in other parts of the Gaza Strip as well. So they're re-engaging in the north. There's been big gun battles in the north, have killed a lot of people there. And there's ongoing military action in the middle of the Gaza Strip as well. So, I mean, it's hard to see any end in sight, given that the military activity has ticked up. Biden also, within the last day or two, he earlier said he was going to withhold a shipment of bombs and military equipment to Israel because he was worried they were going to use it on civilians. That shipment has now been approved. It's on its way. So it looks like it's moving in the direction of the military action continuing, at least in the short term.
And yeah, as always with many of these developing stories, it's really hard to make too many predictions about what's going to happen, because you know, the fog of war means that it's better to have a few weeks of hindsight on the situation before you make any massive opinions about it. And I think that's about all for some of these geopolitical issues around the world. And we will probably wrap this up here. We're well out of time, I think. So if you've got any final, I guess, comments or insights on the week in politics here, let us know. Otherwise, just tell the audience where they can follow you, and then we will basically wrap up the show.
Yeah, well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm William McGimsey at The Zeitgeist NZ, and I've also recently started a YouTube channel where I'm going to post all my podcast appearances. So you can, that's at The Zeitgeist NZ on YouTube as well.
Well, thank you very much for joining me today. And I very much enjoy your insights on Twitter, so I definitely encourage people to follow you there. And also, they can send any thoughts or comments, text us in 2057 and email inbox@realitycheck.radio. I'd love to hear from you in the audience and respond to your feedback. And I'll respond to some of last week's feedback right after this break. So stay tuned. And we've got a few final items before we wrap up the show today. And thank you again for joining me, William.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.